You might say Iron Man meets the fog of war.
CIA on the line.
I've got Langley on the line. You want to know if it's us?
No, it definitely is not us, sir.
It wasn't Navy.
It wasn't Marines.
I need answers.
Oh, wait, hold
the
on.
The country's largest.
Time out a second. Come on now. Let's think about it.
Hey, Afghanistan is no movie, and Obama is not Iron Man. The Obama administration may not get a timeout in Afghanistan, where this morning there are more casualties, more questions, and Congress wants to put on the brakes. Getting it right in Afghanistan, it's only a movie on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, September 14th. I'm John Huckenberry. Coming up this hour, Congress pushes ahead on health care. Are we in focus? We'll find out a little bit later. Chinese tires and American chickens, their weapons in a trade war that may be brewing between China and the United States. And how are you connected to your kids? Is texting a good idea? Family communication in the high-tech world? That's later on in the program. But first, Marvin Weinbaum, a scholar at the Middle East Institute, former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. He joins us now. We played that clip, Marvin, from 60 Minutes, and the president wasn't referring to Afghanistan at all there. In fact, Obama hasn't really mentioned Afghanistan recently. When do you think the headlines on this battlefield are going to overtake Obama's domestic agenda?
Well, I think there are probably two ways to approach that. One is, of course, the course of the war in the next 18 months. If we should see a continued uptick in violence and lack of progress, undoubtedly that's going to come forward. But I think the other thing is the American public seems to be focused on one thing at a time. And if the economy continues to dominate the headlines, our attention, then I think Afghanistan will continue to be somewhat in the background. But should the domestic agenda cool off a bit, I think that the focus will turn again on Afghanistan.
Well, we'll be turning the focus on Afghanistan in just a moment. Marvin Weinbaum, stay with us. First, everything else you need to know this morning in the headlines. President Obama heads to Wall Street today to mark the anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. He'll pitch bankers on his plans to reform financial regulation. From Wall Street to health care, the president told CBS News last night that health care overhaul is not dead.
I believe that we will have enough votes to pass not just any health care bill, but a good health care bill.
That's as Senate Finance Committee chair or committee member Kent Conrad says the committee has only one health care, is the only health care bill with any chance of passing, public option not in the cards, according to Kent Conrad. Meanwhile, a new audio tape believed to be from Osama bin Laden calls the president, quote, powerless to stop the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're going to talk about this in just a moment. And this morning, China called for talks with Washington on a brewing global trade dispute that pits Chinese tires against American chickens. Last week, Washington announced new tariffs on Chinese tires. Markets were down slightly at the close on Friday, but the China story is moving markets this morning. Futures suggest a down opening when Wall Street opens next hour. It will open at 96.05 on the Dow. The S&P starts trading at 10.43, and the Nasdaq begins at 20.81. Healthcare has been making headlines for months out of Washington, but what do you need explained on the healthcare debate in Washington? Is it coming into focus for you? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@takeaway.org. We'll answer your questions online and on the air.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Two big stories overnight that relate to Afghanistan. I'm John Huckenberry, flying solo this morning, and we're going to tackle Afghanistan in this segment first on The Takeaway. An 11-minute audio tape that we've heard overnight, believed to be the voice of Osama bin Laden. Technically, it's a tape commemorating 9/11, but it's a couple of days late. But in the tape, the voice describes President Barack Obama as, quote, powerless to stop the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. The voice also says Americans' inability to grasp why the September 11th attacks occurred has cost you, according to the voice, a lot without any result whatsoever. The other big story out of Afghanistan this morning, casualties. It started as an ambush. The U.S. Army lost five troops this weekend in a wave of bombings and attacks that swept across the country. And all of this informs the debate on whether there is going to be a surge of forces, American troops, NATO troops in Afghanistan. Congress, according to Chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Carl Levin, Congress says maybe no.
We need a surge of Afghan security forces.
And we have not done nearly enough to put that in motion.
If there's a surge, it will be Afghan security forces, not U.S. forces, according to Carl Levin. Joining us to talk about the consequences of all of this is Howard Hart, who worked for the CIA for years, including several years in Afghanistan during the 1980s. During that time, he led the American effort to support Afghan fighters against the Russians. And we welcome back Marvin Weinbaum, scholar at the Middle East Institute, former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's on the line from Atlanta, Georgia. Marvin, thanks for joining us. And Howard Hart worked for the CIA for years, including several in Afghanistan during the 1980s, when you'll recall the U.S. was supporting the insurgency that fought the Russians who had invaded Afghanistan. Howard Hart, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
All right, we begin with you, Marvin. First of all, how do we assess these casualties? Is it fair to say that the Taliban has managed to maintain a military prowess that has, at least according to some in Congress, meant that the U.S. has lost the initiative on the ground against the Taliban?
Well, we lost the initiative within the, well, let's say the last two, three years. We have to remember that the Taliban strategy has been, from the very beginning, just to outlast us. They're on course on that, because this is precisely what is in their game plan, at with additional casualties, that the U.S. and others will lose heart in the mission, and that if they wait and just hang in long enough, are they going to succeed?
And it seems as though that's what Osama bin Laden is betting by describing President Barack Obama as powerless. What do you think the implication of this new audio tape is? Does it have any relevance to what's going on in Afghanistan, or is it all for domestic U.S. consumption?
Well, I think it may be as much for consumption in the Middle East and that region. First of all, what he's announcing is once again that I'm still around. The movement is still alive, we're not going to take the pressure off. Beyond that, I think the most significant thing is, if it's authenticated, is that yes, and I'm still alive.
Does that constitute a seizing of the initiative? I mean, is it possible that NATO has gotten itself in a situation that simply an 11-minute audio tape is as provocative as anything NATO and U.S. forces do on the ground in Afghanistan, Marvin Weinbaum?
Well, we've made it into that. We've made Osama bin Laden, I believe, far more important than he is. There are very few analysts who suspect that he's really running a tight ship there with a command and control of what's going on. He is inspiration. Someone who I believe is a critical figure, but only in a symbolic way.
All right, Marvin Weinbaum, hold on there. Let's listen again to Carl Levin, Democrat and chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, talking about what he believes is the most urgent task in Afghanistan right now, and that's training Afghan military forces.
We should complete the planned number of additional combat forces that are planned to go in for this year. But that what we must do, if we're going to succeed in Afghanistan, is to focus on the strength of the Afghan military forces.
Howard Hart, you had experience back in the 80s of funding the insurgency against the Soviet forces inside Afghanistan. And, of course, the Soviets were trying to get the Afghans to pick up the fight as well, and Afghan forces didn't do very well. Does the Democrat there, Carl Levin, have a misguided confidence in Afghan military forces being able to pick up the slack against the Taliban?
John, I really think he does. I got to know the Mujahideen, as we then called them, the Afghan insurgents, very well. And the shortest thing to say about them is they are indomitable. They are not going to quit. They don't tend to want to quit. When we switch to the question, as Levin suggests, of creating a very large Afghan army and a very large Afghan police force, that sounds great. But the problem is this: when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, they had a Soviet-trained Afghan army that numbered about 80,000 men. Within the first 15 months of the insurgency, meaning when we started pouring in real assistance, that army disappeared, and it went down to about 15,000 men within 15 months. They went home. Now, to think that we could raise, let's say, an Afghan army anywhere between 300,000 and 400,000 men, which is really what would be needed, is simply not possible for a number of reasons. One is their loyalties are to tribes, and they have no loyalty to a central government. To most Afghans, what's a central government? Never has been one, never will be one, in their view. So their basic fundamental loyalties are to their tribes, not to a government. And I suspect, I've heard hints that the efforts thus far to build an Afghan army and an Afghan national police have gone much more slowly than they expected or hoped NATO did, because so many have defected already.
Howard Hart, is there a certain irony here in that you worked with Bill Casey at the CIA to fund the Mujahideen? Many of the same leaders of that insurgency are behind the Taliban, if you're talking about Hekmatyar and, if not directly, Osama bin Laden. The insurgency certainly benefited from U.S. assistance back in the 80s. Are we facing that blowback directly now on the battlefield?
Well, in many ways we are. The big problem was is once the Soviets withdrew because they couldn't take the pressure put on by the insurgents, is the United States just walked away. We just left Afghanistan alone, and the end result of that was the arrival of the Taliban. It's important to note, John, that not all the insurgents are Taliban. There are a great many people who are fighting against us who have arrived at a tacit agreement, in most instances with Taliban forces, to go ahead and fight the foreigners. I mean, the fundamental issue here is there are just most Afghan tribals want all the foreigners out.
Right. Well, and let's get a final thought from Marvin Weinbaum on that point. Howard Hart was involved in funding the insurgency back in the 1980s, where we had a very different strategy, Marvin Weinbaum. What if, and some in the Congress have called for a withdrawal of troops, even George Will has called for a withdrawal of troops, would departing Afghanistan now create the same kind of conditions that produced 9/11, Marvin Weinbaum?
I believe that this is a Herculean task, obviously, but any withdrawal now is going to create conditions which are region-wide. We've unfortunately focused so strongly on just al-Qaeda. What we've got here is the very stability of the region, and unless we redefine our mission there as one which includes Pakistan and the future of Pakistan, Indian-Pakistan relations, the fact that we will be announcing to the extremist world there that we are backing off, and once again the United States is an unreliable ally. I think as I say, there would be enormous consequences if we leave. It's going to have to be
right,
with some success at our back.
Well, thanks for that, Marvin Weinbaum, scholar at the Middle East Institute and former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Also, thanks to Howard Hart, who worked for the CIA for years, including several years in Afghanistan during the 1980s when the Soviets were invading Afghanistan. A lot of lessons from that period as well. Coming up, Todd Zwillick takes us through the healthcare debate. Is anything coming into focus? And you can reach us if you think you need an explainer on healthcare, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
There's no stopping Todd Zwillick. Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry, and checking in now with the Takeaway Capital correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Todd, it seems like the Gang of Six all of a sudden is the center ring in the healthcare debate. Maybe we should add a name to that. President Obama makes it a Gang of Seven. If that's the center ring, what is the Senate Finance Committee going to produce this week, do you think, on healthcare?
Yeah, well, that's right, John. The president pushed this game along a lot last week when he made that speech in front of the joint session. And Max Baucus's latest deadline to have an agreement from the bipartisan Gang of Six and the Finance Committee, as you mentioned, is tomorrow. That's the 15th. Democratic aides told me over the weekend they do expect an announcement on that either tomorrow or Wednesday at the latest. Of course, these deadlines are known to slip. Now Baucus has said he's moving ahead with votes in the Finance Committee next week, whether he gets a bipartisan agreement or not. He may or may not get one, but he's going to produce a plan this week. And this plan's going to carry a lot of water for what the president said he wants in the speech, banning insurance companies from keeping you off the rolls for pre-existing conditions, banning them from dropping you if you get sick, and also, you know, some of the big picture items, insurance exchange for uninsured people in small business. What we won't see in this, John, in this finance draft is any form of public option that the president still says he wants. Instead, the committee's working on a co-op model for private nonprofits that can access the on the exchange. Hopefully the idea there is to lower the price of coverage. In the House, meanwhile, I have to tell you, we're going to see what happens with South Carolina Republican Joe Wilson following the you lie outburst of last week.
I'm so sick of Joe Wilson. I'm sick of Joe Wilson.
Sorry, buddy.
That story's... Put it aside.
Well, here's the thing about this. They want to put it aside, okay?
Well, but it seems like the Obama administration has compromised on a lot of Joe Wilson's issues, like illegal immigrants and even tort reform. What else?
Well, this was kind of a sideshow. You know, there's been a traveling sideshow that's followed Barack Obama all throughout. You know, death panels and the education speech. This is another one. And you're right. Immigration has become an issue now because of what he said. And yes, it's a side issue. It's a small issue. But they do feel like if they don't get Joe Wilson to apologize or some kind of reprimand, even though they don't want this to overtake the healthcare debate the way Henry Louis Gates did, you know, Beer Summit, if they don't do it, this only gives a reason for the next person to do the same thing. Because, look, immigration's a little bit of an issue this week. They have to clarify the language in the bill because of what Joe Wilson said. So if they don't reprimand him or get him to apologize publicly, the next person's just going to do the same thing and say, hey, look, I'm a backbencher. I can get on the map, too.
Well, apologies or not, it seems like a week for the conservatives on health care, whether you're Democrats or Republicans. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much. Takeaway Capital correspondent. And now let's check in with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Louise, the president is going to give a speech a year after Lehman Brothers collapsed on Wall Street, or at least the building across the street from the New York Stock Exchange. What's the significance of the timing and the place?
Well, of course, where he's giving the speech is Federal Hall, which, you know, in the early days of the country, that used to be the nation's capital, and that's where George Washington delivered the first State of the Union address. And so he's here to address Wall Street and kind of tell them that he's not forgotten about financial reform. Some of the biggest things that we're looking at in financial reform, which may be coming up in different legislation on the Hill.
Chris Dodd is going to be heading up that whole thing.
That's right. And Barney Frank Senator, has been already pushing aggressively here. Questions about derivatives, those complicated investments that had a lot of people worried during the crisis. They still exist. How do you add more transparency there? We're looking at the prospect of a systemic risk regulator who would watch everyone. And we're looking at some sort of consumer protection agency. So, you know, some people thought this might have been lost because of the healthcare debate. But on this anniversary, we've got a lot of people in Washington as well as Obama telling us, no, we're on it. We're going to look for change, and that change is needed.
You know, the symbolism you mentioned that George Washington gave the first State of the Union address from Federal Hall overlooking what became the stock exchange. Do you think a year ago, of course, people on Wall Street relied on Washington to save their, you know, excuse me's, and I'm wondering if today Wall Street recognizes, as President Obama steps into Federal Hall, that the power of the financial sector resides in decisions made at the Fed and in Washington. Does Wall Street believe that this morning?
You know, a lot of the biggest players in Wall Street have already given the bailout money back. About $70 billion has been returned. And frankly, a lot of those companies feel that they're done. They're free of Wall Street. They're free of Washington. They're going back to their own ways. And they don't want a lot more government intervention. So that's the question. And a lot of them are even saying that they would have survived without Washington, that they just took the bailout money to help and to be, you know, cooperative.
We did you a favor by taking the money.
We did you a favor to let you save us. So
the subtext will be very important.
That's
today.
Right.
Thank you. Louise Story, of course, a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And And check in now with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen on the U.S. Open. It appears that Clijsters is for real and Nadal is not. Explain.
Well, Clijsters is now the U.S. Open champion, and that's...
Kim Clijsters.
Correct, Kim Clijsters. This is like a flash forward going back to the future in 2005, when the last time that she won. She is now the U.S. Open champion, and she's the Williams killer.
And she's a mom.
Without a doubt.
Indeed. Now, let's talk about the Serena Williams controversial footfall call that, in some sense, cost Serena Williams that semifinal match.
Without a doubt, it cost her the match. The call was controversial. There was only two in the entire tournament. And then when you look at the replay, it was inaccurate. So Serena's anger was justified in the sense that it wasn't really – it didn't make sense what happened. But that's – everyone's focusing on her anger and her reaction.
And her anger, let's just be clear, cost her a point, right?
Precisely. And it cost her a match point, and that set her up to lose. And I think I'm more interested in a judge making a call of this magnitude at this point in the match. I don't think that should happen. And I think someone should be looking at the judge.
All right. Do you think they will be?
I don't think they will. I don't think that that's what happens. But I think that they should investigate and say, is this the type of way that we want to govern tennis matches?
Is there some sort of broader racial question here? McEnroe, I mean, you know, he lipped off to everybody that sat in the chair during his period at the U.S. Open and in all of the tennis matches, Wimbledon especially. He never had a call go against him that was as decisive as this. Will people be saying this is all about Serena?
I think there's definitely a racial question, but there's also a gender question here as well. Mm-hmm. A man can go crazy, can say whatever he wants, and then Serena Williams can go up, and she has one outburst that we can remember. I mean, the other day, Gonzalez...
This is not a pattern of hers at
precisely,
all.
Precisely.
The first offense, in a sense.
And she said in her press conference...
And it was a bad call.
And she's like, I've never been in a fight in my life. I don't know what she would be afraid of me for. I mean, obviously, she's one of the best athletes in the world. I would be afraid of her if she's mad at me, there's probably a reason.
Right. We got to go, but Federer from now on.
It's all about
right?
Federer. He's going to place Juan Martín Del Potro, and I think it's all about him and his unbelievable backhand.
Del Potro have a chance?
He definitely has a chance. He's been playing great tennis.
Yeah, well, it'll be great to see him.
Indeed.
Thanks so much, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, talking about the U.S. Open, which the men's final is tonight, right?
Correct.
Thank
Good
you,
morning.
Ibrahim.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Coming up, we'll nail down this week's agenda with Marcus Mabry and Jill McGivering of the BBC. But right now, Femi Okeh is here for a check on some of today's top news stories.
Thank you, John. In the headlines at 28 minutes to the top of the hour, President Obama is heading to New York for a speech on the economy. Today marks 1 year since the investment firm Lehman Brothers fell apart. The president is speaking at Federal Hall in the heart of Wall Street. He'll talk about ongoing efforts to fix the global economy. Osama bin Laden apparently has a new message for the president. In a new audio tape, he says, I'm going to quote him here, that Obama is powerless, end of quote, to stop the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. The audio recording was released along with a still picture of bin Laden. It's not really verified whether it is his voice. Now, the tape comes just after the 9/11 anniversary. It's also in the wake of several American deaths in Afghanistan over the weekend. And finally, Connecticut police are now looking for a killer in the case of the missing Yale grad student. They found what they believe to be the body of Annie Lay in a school building last night. Those are some of the big stories we're watching this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
Answering the question of what's on the agenda or at the top of the agenda this week is actually a little bit easier than it usually is. Joining us now, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. And Jill McGivering is the BBC Asia editor, joining us now from London. Marcus and Jill, good morning to you both. And it seems to me that this story that the Obama administration tried to slip in on a sleepy Saturday is probably going to be a big mover of markets, certainly this morning and possibly all week long. The Obama administration puts tariffs on Chinese tire imports. The Chinese reacted immediately. First of all, Marcus, is this the opening shot in what could be a trade war? And who's got more weapons?
Well, it's interesting. You know, this would actually be, I think, a war of mutually assured destruction if you were really to see an actual trade war between the United States and China. It's interesting to see because usually what we see is we see these kind of spats spring up and a very, very quick de-escalation. This time we haven't seen that. The Chinese are actually taking the first steps to actually impose their own kind of punitive tariffs on American exports.
Which products?
Of chicken parts, which is a huge issue. The world is not usually aware of it, but it's a huge issue around the world, our export of chicken parts. Automotive parts, which, of course, is an important and delicate and vulnerable industry in the United States.
Jill McGivering, does the Obama administration have the wherewithal to play this out? It's a jobs issue here in the United States, but markets seem to move in response to this story over the weekend. Where do you think it goes from here?
I think the danger is it is a very emotive issue in both countries. No question, as you say, it's to do with jobs in the US. Everyone's concerned about that. Everyone's hurting at the moment. But in China, too, there tends to be a sense, as soon as they see any kind of moves towards tariffs like this, there tends to be a sense of that's hostility towards us. That's the US behaving in an unfair way, being protectionist, just hurting us. And of course, China, too, is very worried about its jobs. It's a massive exporter now. It's just become the world's number one exporter and very conscious, of course, of its huge trade deficit in its favour with the US. But even so, a lot of people there are very anxious. We have migrant workers who don't have jobs anymore, and they're very concerned about keeping those markets open.
But Robert Gibbs, the spokesman for President Obama aboard Air Force One over the weekend, says, no, this is simply about, playing by the rules.
This is simply about enforcing the rules of the road and creating a trade system that is based on those rules and is fair for everyone.
Quickly, Jill McGivering, the Chinese announced 8% growth on Friday. Do they really have an argument here about their migrant workers and their workers and their sort of internal stability with 8% growth going?
They need 8% growth. That's certainly how they feel about it, that they're trying to keep this massive economy going. We're talking about, well over 1 billion people and large numbers flooding onto the labour markets every year with all those students coming on. So they really need it just to stay where they are. For them, it's not really growth. It's kind of status quo.
All right. Here's Dick Durbin on Meet the Press over the weekend. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois talking about another kind of war, Marcus Mabry. Listen to this.
The fact is, we are not going to miss this opportunity. We invite the Republicans to join us for this historic opportunity. If they do not, we are still going to go forward.
Senator Dick Durbin suggesting that the Democrats will go it alone on health care. The president spoke last week. He was on 60 Minutes last night. Dick Durbin spoke on Meet the Press over the weekend. Can they deliver on that promise, the Democrats, either in the Senate or in the House?
They will. The chances are at this point enormous. There will, in fact, be a health care reform bill that actually passes both houses. The big question, and this is a great thing to watch this week on the agenda, is to see what comes out of the Senate Finance Committee. This has become a little bit like waiting for Godot. We've been waiting for this before the Senate even recessed over the summer. Once again, we hear from Max Boggs' committee. They actually expect something out of their committee this week. That will be our first and our last evidence of whether or not there will be a bipartisan agreement on this and whether we'll actually see, and by bipartisan, I mean probably one Republican, Senator Collins of Maine, signing on to it, or whether we'll have an all-Democratic deal. We're talking about 18% of the American economy is health care. Mm-hmm. This is a huge issue. For there to be no Republican sign on, I think, would be tough for the Democrats. For there to be no reform at all would be even tougher for the Democrats.
Definitely something to watch. The lead stories this morning, Jill McGivering, are the latest fighting in Afghanistan. 5 U.S. soldiers killed on Saturday. A new message from what's believed to be Osama bin Laden describing President Barack Obama as powerless on the ground in Afghanistan. How do you think that's going to play this week, Jill McGivering?
I think there's going to continue to be quite a big focus on the messy election that we're seeing, with these results still not very clear, still massive allegations of fraud, and the election commission there in Kabul still having to decide at the moment which votes, and sometimes we're talking about the output from entire polling stations, they're going to count. It's looking at the moment as though Hamid Karzai has got what he needs, he's got beyond that 50% mark, but we just don't know how many of those votes that have been counted so far are actually going to be counted in the final tally, whether they will stand. If we end up with maybe a runoff. Certainly if we end up with a continuation of this very messy process with allegations of fraud and corruption and so on, it's bad news for everybody, including the US, who of course had focused on bringing democracy to Afghanistan and saying Afghans are ready for this Western style of democracy.
Does this
the question of whether the strategies are working.
Jill McGivern, does this mess reduce the credibility of the Obama administration in Afghanistan and, say, even across the border in Iran, where there are fraud allegations and the U.S. has less of an argument against Iran if they're going to stick with Hamid Karzai, yes?
Absolutely, I think so. And I think it was interesting, as we were going into the elections, a lot of people were saying, well, should we be expecting them to be free and fair? After all, it's Afghanistan. And I think that kind of, when you start talking like that, it sort of lowers expectations. But it's also like, well, you know, democracy is democracy. Either it's right or it isn't. Corruption is the same wherever it is. You can't say, if it's an ally, then we won't look so hard. So I think it has really raised concerns.
All right, Jill McGivern, our partner at the BBC, talking to us on The Agenda this morning. Here's Dick Durbin of Illinois. One more thought, Marcus Mabry.
I think that the president is going through a reevaluation with our new General McChrystal as the commander of the NATO forces. I think at this point, sending additional troops would not be the right thing to do.
Marcus Mabry, New York Times. Will there be more troops in Afghanistan? You got 2 seconds.
Yes.
All right. Thanks so much. There's your agenda. Thank you, Marcus. Thank you, Jill. Coming up, how technology is helping parents stay in touch with their kids, or how it's not helping. It's our family issue. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we may never be finished counting the impacts of the financial collapse a year ago. A year ago today, Lehman Brothers collapsed, for instance. But the impact on things outside the financial industry are also worth noting. Performance art actually was affected by the financial collapse a year ago, it's safe to say. And a performance artist and visual artist is in the studio now with me. Jeffrey Raymond is an artist, and it's fair to call you a portraitist of an event, isn't it?
Yes, I think fair enough.
Fair enough. You created a piece of performance art in addition to a portrait of some of the well-known characters in the financial collapse a year ago. I'm looking at a painting of yours right now here in the studio called The Fallen Prince. And who is that a picture of?
It's a portrait of Alan Greenspan.
Portrait of Alan Greenspan, dappled in a kind of Jackson Pollock sort of, but maybe even Chuck Close style would be reminiscent there. And all around it are, it looks like, writing signatures. Explain what those sentences and signatures are all about there.
Well, the whole idea behind my work is that I pick a controversial Wall Street guy at a controversial moment of time. I paint him, and then I take him outdoors, usually in the Wall Street area, and passersby write what they want to write. In this case, it happened right after Greenspan had testified in front of Congress last fall and acknowledged that his idea about unfettered markets was, in fact, flawed. There's a lot of anger directed at him by the Wall Street community, and it's on the painting.
Read a couple of those, if you could, because you basically sat out there on Wall Street where Barack Obama is going to give a speech today and offered people the chance to sign your painting of Alan Greenspan. You've also done other portraits as well. And what did some people say?
One of my favorites is, some are serious, some are not. Somebody wrote, your belief in the self-correcting nature of the free market in an environment of high risk, high reward seems Pollyannish. Somebody else wrote, Woody Allen Greenspan, you know, which annoys me.
Where is Ayn Rand? Someone wrote. Is this the end of capitalism? Some wrote. Was there a sense of solidarity with what you were trying to achieve out there? Or, I mean, these Wall Streeters tend to be pretty busy running from place to place. I can't imagine anybody even stopped, but the painting is filled with signatures.
Well, my paintings, I'm relatively well recognized on Wall Street, and they're a sort of an event, and people do stop. There's at least 250 things written on this one. And I think that catching Greenspan, the reason I called it The Fallen Prince was 5 years ago, everybody thought Greenspan was, in fact, he walked on water. And when he acknowledged that his theories about self-correcting markets were in fact flawed, people, I think, were motivated to say what they had to say. Somebody said they should have brought him in with leg irons.
Right. And, you know, they don't pull punches on Wall Street when they're feeling pretty angry.
No, there's a lot of anger on this painting.
You're headed back to Wall Street this morning, right? Describe what you're going to do and what you expect to happen.
Well, a year ago, as you know, Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. The next day, I was standing in front of Lehman Brothers with a portrait of Richard Fold. I thought this
who's
year.
Who's the head of Lehman Brothers?
Who is the ex-head of Lehman Brothers.
Yeah, arrogant, sort of, we cannot fail, and then boom, he was out of a job.
Too big to fail. apparently not.
Nobody is.
And I thought for the one-year anniversary, I would paint both Fold and Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, who more or less was the decision maker that said we're not bailing out Lehman Brothers.
All right, well, you can go to thetakeaway.org to see a slideshow of Jeffrey Raymond's portraits. He'll be down on Wall Street this morning. The performance art and the financial collapse continues. Thanks, Jeffrey.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up, getting kids to stay in touch with their parents. Does technology help parents, or is it a disenabler of communication in families? We're going to talk about that in a moment. We're also asking you to get in touch with us. Healthcare is a complicated issue. If you need an explainer, tell us at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We'll be answering your questions online and on the air. Now, Femi Okeh has some headlines.
And the headlines coming to you at almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama will be on Wall Street as traders start their week. He's giving a speech at noon Eastern time on fixing the economy. Today marks 1 year since the once mighty investment giant Lehman Brothers collapsed. The ringleader of a giant plot to blow up transatlantic planes now faces at least 40 years in jail. A British judge sentenced Abdullah Ahmed Ali today. He led a group that planned to use liquid explosives. The case led to the current limits on taking liquids on planes, and others involved have already gotten decades in prison. A trade fight between the United States and China is getting bigger. China now wants the World Trade Organization to look at a new U.S. tariff on Chinese-made tires. China is also hitting back by launching anti-dumping probes into American chicken and auto products. Now, we're just learning of a rare and dramatic emergency landing in Germany today. The landing gear failed on a passenger jet carrying a top politician, so it had to land on a layer of protective foam. Nobody was injured. And finally today, Roger Federer takes on Juan Martín Del Potro for the U.S. Open men's title. Yesterday, Kim Clijsters beat Caroline Wozniacki for the women's trophy. And those are some of the big stories we're watching today.
Thank you, Femi.
Roll out of the shadows and find that eventually there we are, where we are, and what we are is still family.
So on Monday, our family conversation refers this morning to something moms and dads have been trying to get their kids to do for a while. Stay in touch. Write a letter, or as the little kids told E.T., phone home. When I went away to college, my mom actually addressed the envelopes that she put in my bag when I went off to Chicago to go to school, saying, please write me back. Well, these days we don't need to use snail mail to stay in touch, but the question is, are families more in communication, whether they're at college or around the dinner table, using tools like BlackBerries, text messaging, phone, video, Skype? Lisa Belkin, who writes the blog Motherload for the New York Times, joins us now from her home in Westchester County, New York. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
And also Sherry Turkle, director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self and author of the book Simulation and Its Discontents. She joins us from Boston. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning.
My first question is to you, Sherry. It was a major effort to get kids to write letters to their parents, but texting is a much easier communicative task. Does it create a back channel to mom and dad? Does it improve communication or just warp it?
Well, it certainly creates a back channel. It certainly is that parents and kids are more in touch. I guess that there is a difference between in touch and really being in communication. And I think that's the question of what are both the gains and the losses of texting. Because what you may get from your child is essentially a touch base. You know, I'm okay. You know, I'm here. I'm okay. You know, we're good. And lose both with your child, but also sometimes with your friends and your spouse the kinds of communication where deeper things are discussed.
Hmm. Lisa Belkin, we've already seen plenty of instances where texting and email relationships have been very, very disruptive to families, at least in the relationship between the parents. What are the incidences of children changing the nature of their communication with their parents using these technological tools?
Well, I've seen it very recently. Our house has been like a laboratory of sorts. We sent a son off to college, and I have always texted with him. That's kind of been my method of communication. So I kept doing that, and I would get these little kind of scattershot updates. And my husband was feeling left out because he wasn't hearing anything. So he sat down on a Sunday and wrote a long email. And he got a long email back. And that's now become their method of communication. So what Sherry is saying is true. I was getting, you know, the touching. He's getting the real meat. And
that's
between the
so
two of us, we're actually talking to him.
You know, in my case, when I went to college, I would just do these really quick 30-second phone calls to my mom. Hey, I'm fine. Yes, the laundry's done. No, there's not a problem in the kitchen, in my dorm room. And my conversation with my dad were these very emotional, long kind of I'm embarking on the road of life kind of letters. And that's sort of interesting. Sherry Turkle, do you think it's possible that technology simulates pre-existing communication channels, or does it create new, maybe sometimes fundamentally dishonest channels that actually conceal more than they reveal?
I think it does both. I mean, it's the needs of teenagers and the needs of parents really haven't changed. And so people make a judgment as to what's around that can meet those needs. But there are some ways, in which the new technologies can subvert sort of the best intentions, the best developmental intentions of kids. So, for example, I'm just thinking about a lot of the interviews I do with kids. They get very upset because, and here's like in the high school context, a teenager wants to not be there. You to not be there when they don't want you, but when they want you there, they need you there. And their parents will come to pick them up after school, to pick them up after a soccer game, and the parents will be texting or on the cell phone and literally not attend to the child until 10 minutes are in. And they experience their parents, and this is not just like a couple of kids, but a lot of kids. They experience that their parents are more invested in what's on the BlackBerry, what's on the iPhone, than in them.
Hmm.
But one kid said, she puts me on pause until she gets around to me.
Yeah, that's what our kids say, actually. My mom is on the laptop a lot, and I think they are constantly questioning, hey, why aren't you paying attention to us?
Yes, and I think that this is a growing development. Because, of course, there's the mom. She's sitting waiting for this pickup for a half hour. I mean, it's the most natural thing in the world to start to do something that then, in her mind can't be dropped the minute the kid shows up. But there's that sense that a child wants to appear and have that parent's full attention. And I think that's something that really needs to be watched. Plus, kids are very upset that their parents text and drive.
Right.
Lots of kids are upset about that.
We get yelled at in our car. Lisa Belkin, what are some stories of successes and failures in communication as you've seen them on the Motherload blog?
Well, it's interesting because there's two sides to everything. And what Sherry is saying is so true. We have to remember we're in charge. There is an off button. And that's my rule. That was the one I came up with, and it was hard won, Sherry. When I pick my children up, I am not on a piece of technology because their reaction was like a slap.
No, we've had to do that in our family too, Lisa. The laptops have to close down at a certain point, or the kids do go nuts. They think you're not paying attention.
On the other hand, I found that texting, particularly, it's a unique, it's a new thing, and it means they can reach out to me when their friends don't know it.
Yes,
and that for me gets rid of all the downsides. I got a text from my son at Halloween a year or so ago saying, can you come get me and tell everyone it was your idea?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
And he needed out. He needed help, and he never could have picked up the phone in that situation. He couldn't have spoken, but he could text.
Oh, that's so interesting. That's our family segment for this Monday. Thanks to both of you, Lisa Belkin and Sherry Turkle, director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. Lisa Belkin writes the Motherload blog for our partner, the New York Times. You know how to get in touch with us, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We know you have a lot to say, like last week when so many of you checked in to talk about Representative Joe Wilson.
Judy, Pittsburgh, Kansas. I don't think that the person should have yelled out, liar, or I think he should have said, that is untrue, you know, and had some backup information.
This is Pete Reynolds from Oswego, Kansas. I listened to the representative's apology. He later made speeches to persons in South Carolina confidentially that he didn't really apologize and he would continue the same behavior. I think it's reprehensible.
Helen wants to talk back to Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports contributor, on the topic of Serena Williams' outburst during the U.S. Open, and it was an outburst. She writes, Serena has a history of emotional reactions, something she herself has admitted. Case in point, reason she had already had one warning in the match. McEnroe was years ago. He'd get his you-know-what handed to him because the rules have changed. Ibrahim should have looked at the rules of behavior that are in place now at the U.S. Open. And today we're asking the question, do you understand the healthcare debate in Washington? We're also talking about this complicated issue. And if you need an explainer, get in touch with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, we have a slideshow of paintings by artist Jeffrey Raymond. He documented the financial collapse in his art, and you can see more of it on thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Let's see, cats have nine lives. Healthcare reform may need a few more.
I think this is the year we're going to get healthcare done. But I guarantee you, this will be pronounced dead at least four or five times before we finally get a bill passed.
Speaking on 60 Minutes, the president tries to steal some more lives for his healthcare initiative. When being declared dead is a sign of political life, we check for a pulse here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Counting lives on healthcare. Good morning. It's Monday, September 14th. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, also, the U.S.-China trade war. Well, maybe it's not a war, but it's certainly a skirmish. I'll see your tire tariffs and raise you a chicken ban. We'll have the details. And in the NFL, Brett Favre still got it. Rafael Nadal does not. We'll check in on the weekend's football and tennis action. And can primetime handle Jay Leno? It's kind of a joke, you know. But first, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us. I think President Barack Obama was brilliant last night on 60 Minutes, Todd. I mean, being pronounced dead is a sign of progress for healthcare. You know, in that quote, he actually wasn't talking himself. He was quoting one of his advisors. And my question to you, Todd, is who do you think the advisor was?
I'm voting for A, Axelrod,
yeah.
B, Rahm Emanuel, or C, the most likely choice, Tom Daschle, who is still advising the White House. But either way, it's all going according to plan.
You know, I vote for Rahm Emanuel, who said it's got to die four or five times before we can get a bill passed. But that's great. We're going to talk more about health care. Is it coming into focus? Todd, stay with us. But everything else you need to know this morning is in the headlines. The president says his health care overhaul is still alive, but Senate Finance Committee member Kent Conrad tells the Fox News Channel his committee has the only health care bill with any chance of passing.
The proposal that we are developing is fully paid for, bends the cost curve in the right way, extends coverage to 94% of the American people, not everybody, but 94% is a big improvement over where we are now.
The plan reportedly doesn't have a so-called public option. From healthcare to the economy, President Obama heads to Wall Street today to mark the anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. He's expected to tell bankers it's time to scale back government bailout programs. A new audio tape believed to be from Osama bin Laden calls the president, quote, powerless to stop the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The tape goes on to say that President Obama has sown new seeds of hatred and revenge against America. It hasn't been officially verified that the voice on the 11-minute tape is Osama bin Laden. Staying overseas, a British court has sentenced the ringleader of a plot to blow up transatlantic planes to at least 40 years in jail. The 28-year-old was convicted of plotting the biggest terrorist attack since 9/11. It involved liquid explosives. It's the reason why you can't carry on liquids in your carry-on luggage. But that's the conclusion of that case in the UK this morning. Markets were down slightly at the close on Friday, but the China story that we talked about a moment ago is actually moving markets. We expect a down opening when Wall Street gets underway about a half hour from now. The Dow opens at 96.05. The S&P starts trading at 10.43. And the NASDAQ begins at 20.81. We're going to talk about the healthcare debate. Is it coming into focus? We're going to explain some of the terms things that are in play in Washington and are going to be for the next couple of weeks. But do you think the healthcare debate needs an explainer? What do you think needs some explaining? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here, flying solo on The Takeaway this morning. You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Basically, is healthcare reform coming into focus now that Barack Obama spoke to a joint session of Congress? He was on 60 Minutes last night saying that whatever bill is passed, he owns it and he will be accountable for it. What bill is he going to own? Do we know more this morning? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, part of the Takeaway family, rejoins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, John.
And everyone here in this segment is from the Takeaway family after fashion. Kate Pickard is a Time magazine staff writer who was responsible for a great piece which kind of deconstructs all of the mysterious terms that are being used in the healthcare reform debate, right?
Yes, that's right.
You're also married to one of our senior producers, correct?
I am.
All right,
I am.
So it's a family show this morning here on The Takeaway. So Todd and Kate, I want to divide this segment in two. First of all, there's a web of relationships in some of the terminology that's being discussed in the healthcare reform debate. And while politically we don't know what the exact bill is going to look like, I think some of the mechanisms are coming into focus. Todd, let me begin with you. A mandate. It appears there will be some form of mandate in a plan that makes it out of the Senate and gets into the markup and becomes a part of the conference negotiations, which could possibly be a final bill. What's that going to mean to me? If I wake up and there's a mandate, does that mean I have to run to the store and buy some insurance, or I'm going to lose my driver's license, or I'm going to get a ticket? What does that mean?
It sort of means you might get a ticket. The draft that Max Baucus and the Finance Committee is working on now there are different forms of mandates in all the different bills. We don't have time to go through all of them. Let's sort of work off the general idea and the one that Max Baucus is working with, because that finance bill is carrying sort of the most weight right now. They have what's called the individual mandate, and you got to think of this more or less like your car insurance. You're not allowed to drive a car unless you have insurance, right? That's the law, and everybody gets insurance, and the reason for that is
you can't even register your car unless you have proof of insurance. So it's a pretty big front-end enforcement mechanism there.
That's correct. And even mandate in politics, and mandate is a dirty word. Nobody likes to be mandated, told you must do this. And that makes sense. People don't like it. But the reason it's in there is because in this way, health insurance, if you want to drive down costs, it is a lot like car insurance. It only really works if everybody has it, because
right.
If half the people on the road don't have it, what's the point of having insurance in the first place? So that just real quickly, the enforcement on this in the Baucus bill, the one they're working off now, is called the individual mandate. Everybody must have health insurance. Now, everybody, there are some exceptions for hardship, for very low income people, for people with just no money. There are a couple of exceptions, but overall, you must have health insurance. If you refuse to get it or don't get it, there's basically a fee, a fine that's in there that starts at around $750 a year. Now, if you're a low-income person, there is help for that. There's exemptions for the fine if you just don't have the money. There's also help for the premiums and the cost of insurance. So it doesn't really say you got to pay $4,000 for insurance or pay the fine if you don't have any money. There's supposed to be some help in there, and there's a sliding scale. But basically, it's an enforceable mandate. We want everyone to get coverage, either paying for it themselves or with some subsidized tax credit or cash help
from
the government.
All right, Todd Zwillick, thanks so much. I get a better idea of what the mandate is, but let's say, Kate Pickard, that I'm a low income, maybe not at the poverty level, but I'm a low income individual who is uninsured. I wake up, I realize there's a mandate. There are going to be some options for me to get insurance. Some are high priced private sector. It doesn't appear there's going to be a public option in this bill, but they are talking about a nonprofit, low cost co-op. If I'm going to go to a co-op to get insurance, if I'm going to meet this mandate requirement, what's that going to look like? Who am I going to call?
Well, the individual mandate, as Todd laid it out very well, but the way that people would go buy insurance if they were uninsured is through something called the exchange,
mm-hmm.
Which we hear a lot about, and it's not a terribly helpful word in understanding exactly what that is.
It's not.
But basically, it's worth explaining. So the exchange is sort of a marketplace where individuals and small businesses, most likely those would be the groups that would be able to purchase insurance through the exchange. So the exchange would sell would be like the conduit that you could buy private insurance plans through, as well as if there is any sort of public or nonprofit option. So
now I can buy a private plan now, and I can call up a broker to do that. But this public plan, and basically the idea is you're gonna make a plan that will take virtually anyone who needs insurance. How would I get in touch with the co-op, the sort of low-end plan?
Right. Well, basically through a website. The Federal Employee Health Benefits Plan, which is how members of Congress and get their health insurance, along with 8 million federal employees, they buy their insurance through an exchange. So the federal employees can go onto a website, enter their zip code and how often they get paid, and they can compare a variety of plans. They're all private plans because right now we don't have a co-op or a public option. And they can choose kind of which plan they like best, and it compares cost and also benefits. So if a co-op plan existed, or if somehow the public option came back, that would be listed alongside other private plans that individuals could purchase.
And the cost savings from a co-op would come from the fact that it's a nonprofit, not that it's a government entity. Todd, explain the last thing to me, and that is something that was discussed over the weekend and has been a part of the debate all of last week, that if there is a public option, it may exist in some abstract form as a trigger, that if something doesn't happen over a period of years, then the public option would be triggered and some sort of Medicare like public insurance program would come into play. What is the trigger, and is it real?
The trigger, basically, John, is a political construct at this point. It's a way for people who favor the public option, and there are a lot of Democrats in the House and Senate, not to mention the president, who favor it. So the trigger is basically the public option on life support, okay? It basically says we're not going to have a public option now. However, the point here is to lower costs and make healthcare more accessible. So we won't have the public option now. However, if costs don't go down by some certain percentage over some 3 or 5 years, or if costs aren't controlled to some degree, by law, a public option would be triggered.
Right.
Now, the Olympia Snowe did say over the weekend, she's on the Finance Committee, she's one of the only Republicans who's still negotiating. She originally came up with the idea of the trigger. She's been pushing it for years. She said she thought the trigger would not be in this bill and that it's dead as far as
so,
the
that, that's
is
about
concerned.
It. That's pretty abstract, Ben. If it's not going to happen for 3 years and Olympia Snowe says it's dead, I'll say it's abstract. We've got some questions.
Hang on, John. Real quick. It doesn't mean it won't come back. They could put it back in conference because they're going to need it to get something through the House, because the House Democrats really want a public option, so it's not completely dead.
All right, Kate, here's a friend of the Takeaway who had a question about the exact kinds of things that motivated this segment to begin with. Here's Will Markham, who's a union GM worker in Pontiac, Michigan.
Is this health care option going to be comparable to what the senators and the congressmen already get for free?
Kate Pickard.
Okay, well, they don't get it for free. Just as, you know, any employee of a private corporation has some payroll deductions to go toward their premium, the same thing happens for federal employees, including members of Congress. But the thing that would be similar to what they do now is the exchange, like I described earlier. So as federal employees can go choose, and they have a lot of choice of various health plans. And because there are 8 million federal employees, they have a lot of leverage to kind of lower costs. So that's part of the value of the exchange.
All right. So it will be somewhat like what senators and congressmen already get, but just not for free. Here's another former guest of the Takeaway, Dr. Michael Promenko of Grand Junction, Colorado. Todd, he has this question.
If we are going to have an individual mandate, wouldn't it be nice to have a nonprofit option for folks that now have to buy insurance instead of going all the way to a government-run public option?
Is Promenko right here? Is nonprofit equivalent to a government-run public option?
Well, nonprofit, he's referring probably to something closer to the co-op
right.
that Kate was just describing. That remains to be seen. Nobody knows how much a public option would cut costs, or how much a nonprofit co-op would cut costs, or whether those two things would really be comparable. You're talking about politics at this point, what people will accept politically, and time has to pass before we see which one, either of these, whether they will cut costs. The idea behind the co-op is, right, it's nonprofit, so there's some money you can save. They could probably save on marketing. They don't have to pay executives $40 million a year. And there could, you know, any profit they do make would be returned back to members, patients, in the form of lower premiums or increased benefits. So in theory, yes, it could keep costs under control, but the healthcare marketplace defies theories right now. So if they put this in place, it's going to take some time to see what really happens to costs.
All right, finally, listener Rebecca Schultz is an energy analyst from Connecticut, has a question which I think you've answered, but Kate Pickard, let's see.
He says now that the public option isn't essential to his plan. So what is his plan without the public? What is the idea without the public option?
Let me try and answer that. Is it co-ops, Kate?
Co-ops are the most likely thing at this point.
Glad I was paying attention. Kate Pickard, Time Magazine staff writer, and Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. We're trying to explain health care. Are you paying attention? What needs clarification for you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, there's a brewing trade war or skirmish between the U.S. and China. Yeah, is it serious or not? How does it affect you? And also, Louise Story joins us. President Obama speaks to Wall Street today. Stay with us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Do the math. We're checking in now with Louise Story, who covers Wall Street and finance for our partners at the New York Times. A year ago, Lehman Brothers went down. We've talked to an artist about it this morning. People on Wall Street will certainly be thinking about it. And the markets are apparently going to be thinking about what's going on with U.S.-China trade, with the tariffs on tires over the weekend. What do you think the reception for Barack Obama will be down on Wall Street this morning?
Well, one thing I was wondering, you know, I live down there in the old J.P. Morgan building, which is right by the stock exchange where he'll be speaking. And so 6 a.m. today, I was walking out, and the barricades were already set up. Obviously, they're expecting a lot of people. But I was wondering, gee, you know, are workers at Goldman Sachs going to leave on their lunch break to come watch him? You know, are we really going to see people from Bank of New York Mellon here? I actually think that a lot of the people there may not be Wall Street workers. They may be protesters. They may be just tourists. So it's not clear if he's going to have workers in person.
Democracy on display, democracy. Not capitalism, indeed.
Right.
Well, you know, you described this earlier this morning, but it bears repeating. And it seems the pendulum has swung, that a year ago we were talking about Wall Street being subservient to the power of Washington. That may still be true in fact, but I think a lot of bankers probably want to get out from underneath the Fed and the U.S. Treasury. And while Barack Obama talks about paybacks from bankers, bankers are happy to leave Washington behind.
That's right. The president, it seems, is going up to New York and up to Wall Street a little bit to re-exert his influence and to say that we are looking at financial reform. He's going to talk about how they're ending some of the bailout programs, but the kind of permanent reforms he wants to put in place. So it does seem to be, you know, kind of him telling Wall Street, we're still here, and you can leave Washington, but I'll come to you on Wall Street.
Has the bailout been a good investment for Washington? Are they going to get their money back?
Well, there's, you know, certain pieces of it where you can see a return, but it's really too soon to know. I mean, we just had a report last week about the money that was given to the auto industry, and a congressional research committee found that a lot of that auto money will never come back. So it's kind of too soon to know. But the thing that the president's going to face is a question of tone. Because, you know, early on last January, when the Wall Street bonus figures came out, he called them shameful. And he said, shame on you, Wall Street, for paying big bonuses. And that was a very angry tone. And that actually hindered the Treasury Department a little bit in working with the banks this spring. So he's become a lot friendlier. And I think, you know, that's one of the things when you look at this anniversary. I've done some reporting recently on the year after with Lehman. And one of the things that I found talking to these workers is the tone is it's difficult to strike the right tone. On the one hand, you're sympathetic to these people who had their lives turned upside down if they worked at Lehman, for instance, and they didn't have a job and they didn't have anywhere to go. And the president, you know, it seems will have to strike some of that sympathy. But on the other hand, to most of America, that doesn't play that well. To most of America, they don't feel that sorry for bankers. And so then you've got to also strike the tone of, we're going to change. We're not going back the old way. So he'll have a kind of a tricky balance.
Well, we will check in and check the tonality as President Obama takes
it'll be interesting.
Podium at Federal Hall overlooking Wall Street later today. Louise Story, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here. First week, official week of the NFL. Plenty to talk about there. But it seems to me the big story this morning is what happened at the U.S. Open over the weekend. We've already gotten a response from one of our listeners. Listen to this.
Hi, this is Mike from Wayne, New Jersey. I cannot believe that he's going to turn this into a racial or gender issue. She told the referee that she was going to shove the racket down her throat. Now, we can talk about McEnroe or the past, but today's game, you lose a point for that. You shouldn't make excuses for these people. They should be better behaved than that.
Serena Williams suggested some sort of violent action to a line coach at the U.S. Open. She lost a point. She was docked a point. It was probably crucial in her match against Kim Clijsters. No racial issue here?
There's always a racial issue when it's when there's the only African American player on the court in a sport that's primarily dominated by white players, in the U.S. tennis. But it's also an issue of passion, and I think she was coming to the game with an incredible amount of passion, and she was playing in a game in a match that she was, you know, just seconds away from winning.
Match point.
Exactly.
Listen to this, Ibrahim. Arthur Ashe wrote in his autobiography, Marcus Mabry gave this to me earlier this morning, "I envied and I loathed John McEnroe," Arthur Ashe writes. "I wanted to act that way, but I couldn't. I wanted to. I couldn't afford myself that luxury," is according to Arthur Ashe. So there's a certain amount of subtext and tension there, even if Serena Williams was wrong in what she said to that line coach.
The reason why we like Americans love George Bush, because he was like the stick-to-it guy and making, you know, keep staying in the course guy, is because sometimes when Americans are wrong, we still want to back them, even because they're passionate and they want to prove their point and they have something to gain by doing that. And so I think with Serena in this instance is that she just has so much passion for the game and she wants to win. So I think from that perspective, give her a little slack.
Yeah. Well, it's a good point. The NFL first week, Brett Favre, does he still have it?
Brett Favre still has it to hand off to Adrian Peterson. Because Adrian Peterson is the best running back in the NFL, and so Brett Favre could be the general of a team that has the best running attack in the game.
How did the Eagles look?
The Eagles look great. They have an excellent defense. They're a very sound team, except that Donovan McNabb went down and he broke his rib. Now that sets up a lot of drama coming up, because obviously we have a guy named Michael Vick, who some people might have heard of, who could end up starting way sooner than anyone could think.
And finally, the Washington Redskins look like nothing against the New York Giants, but New York sports fans are talking all about how good Sanchez looked at the New York Jets.
Mark Sanchez looked great yesterday, but the real thing when he looked is he looked poised. And I think right now he has a great offensive line around him, and he just looks ready to play in the NFL, and that's what they're excited about.
Any other sort of standouts on the West Coast?
Well, the West Coast. Well, San Francisco. San Francisco beat the defending NFC champions. The 49ers beat the defending NFC champions in the Arizona Cardinals, and that was a surprise game.
That was a big surprise game. I mean, what a trip down memory lane.
It's true.
If the 49ers are still in it. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks.
Thank you. Good morning.
Ibrahim, the Takeaway sports contributor. Now let's take a look at some of the top stories that we're following with Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. 29 minutes past the hour. The president was on 60 Minutes last night, where he promised to get the health care bill right.
I intend to be president for a while, and once this bill passes, I own it.
Now, the president said that just as the Senate Finance Committee member, Senator Kent Conrad, says that his committee has the only health bill with any chance of passing. Police say that they found a body they believe to be Annie Lay, a Yale graduate student who's been missing since Tuesday. The body was found inside the lab where she was last seen alive. And overseas, a British court has sentenced the ringleader of a plot to blow up transatlantic planes to at least 40 years in jail. Let's look at the big stories we're following.
Coming up, U.S. and China in a trade skirmish. We'll get the reaction from Beijing. And if you need an explainer on healthcare, you know how to reach us.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. They're kicking themselves on Wall Street this morning. Investors beginning downward as traders seem to be reacting to Barack Obama kicking the tires in announcing a 35% increase in tariffs on Chinese tire products. China responded immediately over the weekend and said that it was taking the first steps to restrict U.S. imports of chicken and auto parts. That would be from the United States into China. And China has also called for the World Trade Organization to mediate talks on an accusation that China says the U.S. is violating global trade rules by announcing those tariffs on Chinese tires over the weekend. Joining us now from Shanghai is Chris Hogg, BBC Shanghai correspondent. There's been a lot of reaction, both officially and from what we might call the street in China. Describe how you're getting this reaction, Chris Hogg.
Yeah, I think it was interesting. I mean, first of all, on Saturday morning, Shanghai time, we saw a very formulaic response from the Chinese government to President Obama's decision on Friday. It was just the usual kind of response criticizing this kind of action. But what happened over the weekend was we saw across the internet here on the various blogs and comment pages, a much more furious reaction from the netizens, as they call them. And I think that you have to remember that the Chinese government, like the Obama administration, has to pay attention to these domestic critics, although, of course, for different reasons. And so what we saw by Sunday evening, Shanghai time, was this new and quite surprising development that China was taking the first steps, launching an investigation into whether or not the Americans unfairly subsidize their exports of chickens and other poultry and auto parts to China. Now, here on Sunday, here today on Monday, we've now got China announcing that it is going to take this, as you said, to the WTO. I mean, it's a furious reaction. When you look at the language from the Chinese officials, the language that they're using is that this is the United States saying one thing, pledging that it's against protectionism, but by its actions showing that it's not.
And we've got additional reaction on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 50 points this morning. The S&P is down, in a mid sort of single percentage point. And the volatility indices on all the U.S. markets are way up. What we've got here, it seems, is an announcement by Obama on Saturday of these tariffs on tires, but also we're reacting now on the third iteration. The Chinese are reacting to domestic reaction, and now the U.S. markets are reacting to Chinese reaction. This is escalating in a way that we haven't really seen before.
Yeah, I mean, this is a worry, really, because this was President Obama's first major trade policy decision. And the signal that he sent, at least as far as the Chinese are concerned, was a protectionist signal. What used to happen under President Bush was there was a lot of rhetoric. But when you actually looked at the kind of decisions that he was making, as far as the Chinese were concerned, they were decisions that was easier to live with. China is worried about this because when you look at the way the Chinese economy works, exports from the United States to China are worth 13 times more than exports to China from the United States. So if this is turns into a trade war, then China potentially can suffer a lot more from this than on the American side.
And the sort of misguided assumption would be that 8% growth in China, which is what they announced on Friday, is actually some sort of comfortable margin of growth. In fact, from the Chinese perspective, 8% growth is about as low as it can get without domestic tranquility coming unraveled.
Yeah, it's a bit like treading water in the bath, and you need to tread water in the swimming pool just to stay afloat. And treading water, the watermark, if you like, for the Chinese is 8%. That's the figure that is generally agreed by analysts to be the kind of economic growth that you need to maintain in order to create enough jobs. But the real worry for the Chinese was that even though we did have a slew of economic data that a lot of people said was more positive at the end of last week, the real worry for them is that they haven't yet created a new growth engine. That 8% growth that they have created is coming from public spending. It's coming from the Chinese tax dollars, if you like. Now, That can't go on forever. And so they need the export sector to pick up. They need the domestic market to pick up too. But the problem they've got with that is if you lose your job here or if you get sick, there's no safety net for you. So the incentive is still to save rather than spend. So they're still relying on exports. And so the idea of a looming trade war, which would damage their ability to export, is a real concern for them.
So there's certainly a jobs issue, which is why the Obama administration went after tires. There are U.S. jobs that are dependent upon the sales of domestic tires in this market. Who's misjudged here? And again, Wall Street reaction seems to be down under 1% on all the indices. Who's misjudged? Did the Chinese misjudge their domestic reaction? Did Obama misjudge the quickness of the Chinese reaction, do you think?
Well, maybe nobody misjudged. I mean, maybe this is all about high politics. I mean, don't forget that although President Obama imposed this tariff of 35% in the first year, which then falls back to smaller amounts in the second and third year, that was still much less than he'd actually been recommended by the U.S. Trade Commission. I think that they were recommending something like 55%.
Right, so, they were.
I'm sure he can argue that this was a more balanced, a more nuanced response. And on the Chinese side, I mean, they've chosen very carefully these new industries that they are targeting, because they are both industries that have a strong lobby in the United States, the car industry and the farm industry. So they've chosen very carefully. They know that if they worry those industries are able to knock on the door of the legislators there in Washington. So, you know, maybe this is all about high politics. Maybe this is actually all very clever. The real concern, though, for the United States, as far as I can see from here in China, is Washington needs Beijing to sort out a number of complex issues, to come to agreement on climate change before the end of the year, to try to ease North Korea tensions, to try to help them with Iran. This is going to make sorting out those kind of issues together a lot harder.
And indeed, if the Obama administration thought it was a conciliatory gesture by only a 35% tariff on Saturday, they're probably rethinking that this morning, as we all are. Thank you so much, Chris Hogg, BBC Shanghai correspondent, talking about what is at least a couple of shots across the bow between China and the United States on trade. And now Femi Oke has a look at the top stories this morning.
Thank you, John. At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, President Obama will be heading to New York this morning. He's giving a speech about reforming the economy. Today marks the one-year mark since the financial services firm Lehman Brothers collapsed. President Obama will speak at Federal Hall in the heart of Wall Street. And Osama bin Laden aims right at the president in an apparent new audio message. He says that the president is, I'm going to quote him here, powerless, end of quote, to stop the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's no authentication for the audio that it is, in fact, Osama bin Laden. That's a look at some big stories we're following.
Another big story, Jay Leno goes on the air tonight at 10 p.m. Does it change the game for television? We'll talk about it in 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Joining us now for this segment, Thomas Kaplan is the editor of the Yale Daily News. It's fair to say that whatever class they're attending this morning, students at Yale will be thinking about developments over the weekend. Annie Lay, a graduate pharmacology student who went missing last Tuesday. Authorities believe they may have found her body. The 24-year-old was found actually walled up in the laboratory building where she was last seen alive. Thomas Kaplan, this is disturbing on so many different levels, but what's the reaction on the Yale campus this morning?
Well, I think this is really a campus in shock. It's no exaggeration to say that. I mean, just the thought that a student could be killed in broad daylight in a weekday in a busy academic building is just something that it's really hard to get your head around.
And they haven't confirmed that they found her body, but certainly the supposition is that this is Annie Lay. But we still don't know, based on forensics, when this crime actually took place and how long that body might have been there, correct?
No, that's a big question. And we're hoping to get more information from the medical examiner later today. But all those details are up in the air right now.
Now, it's not as though this was in a dorm. It's not as though this was an undergraduate. Tell us about the setting for what appears to be the crime scene here and whether students today are likely to encounter even that building.
Well, most undergraduates are not. The medical school campus is to some extent separate from the central campus, but this is a very busy building. It's a state-of-the-art laboratory. It's more than 100,000 square feet. I mean, hundreds of people go in and out during the day. It's certainly not the type of place where you would expect someone to want to commit a crime like this and think they could get away with it, given the number of surveillance cameras and the activity there.
Well, you know, this is a pharmacology lab, and I suspect there's a lot of proprietary intellectual property issues in a building like that. So, as you say, there's probably high security. Do they have a sense, based on sort of the comings and goings and the video surveillance, of who would have been in the building at the time as they search for suspects?
Well, that's the thing. There are more than 70 cameras outside the building, so no one could get in the building without being caught on tape. And even more than that, to get into the basement where her body was found, you need to swipe your Yale ID, and only a select number of people even have access to the basement. So investigators think that'll be a big advantage in trying to narrow down perhaps a pool of suspects.
Now, this may be premature to be raising this issue, but so many big campuses, you know, big high-level Ivy League campuses are conducting basically industrial research on campus, and that in some sense a building like this may be independent of the regular sort of academic mission of Yale. How much has that come up in campus reactions that, you know, this is a building that's a part of the Yale campus,
yeah,
but maybe it's not in some way?
It's hard to tell. I think one thing that has been clear is that, you know, until the body was found, I think at least among undergraduates, you know, it was a little hard to get a sense of, you know, sort of the just how much of an impact this might have, because the medical campus is somewhat separate, and because, you know, these types of laboratories, you're right, I mean, this is not what you think when you think of a college campus, undergrad sitting in classrooms around a table reading great books. I mean, it's a whole different ballgame.
Right. Any sense of the deceased, Annie Lay? Just a couple of details, anything beginning to emerge? We just have a few seconds.
About her as a person?
Right.
Well, I mean, I think people say, you know, she was a top student, had a lot of promise, was very outgoing, and that's why I think it's
right.
So tragic.
Real tragedy. Thomas Kaplan, editor of the Yale Daily News, where they're on pins and needles, at the very least, at Yale today, based on the discovery of what appears to be the body of 24-year-old Annie Lay. Thank you, Thomas.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Leno at 10 p.m. in primetime starting tonight. What is it about? Leno's career? Is it about the future of comedy and television, or is it about NBC's bottom line? We'll find out in just a few minutes. Also, healthcare. Are you looking for an explainer in this complex issue and this almost impenetrable debate? What do you need explained? Regina Tusky in Huntington Woods, Michigan emails us, "I hate to sound paranoid, but I heard that Congress and federal employees are exempted from the requirements of the new bill. Is that, if that is true, why? It seems to me if this bill is supposed to be good for all, no one should be exempted. Makes it look like the bill is for you guys, but we're happy with what we have, so we'll just keep it." Tell us your concerns at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We'll answer those questions on the air and online. Right now, Femi Okay has a check of today's top headlines.
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, chickens exported from the U.S. to China are at the center of a growing trade fight. China wants the World Trade Organization to investigate a new American tariff on Chinese tires. And China is also moving to slap tariffs on American chicken and car products. President Obama is heading to Wall Street later today. He's making a speech about ongoing work on the economy. Today marks 1 year since Lehman Brothers collapsed. In sports, Roger Federer takes on Juan Martín del Potro in the U.S. Open's men's title held today. Yesterday, Kim Clijsters beat Caroline Wozniacki for the women's trophy. And finally, the Iraqi reporter Muntada Al-Zaidis, who threw his shoes at former President George W. Bush, will be released tomorrow rather than today. His brother says that paperwork delays have prevented his release today as scheduled. Now, meanwhile, the reporter's nieces and nephews have been rehearsing a song to welcome their uncle home. Have a listen, and you'll hear the kids singing about former President Bush.
What?
Now, if you need a translation, the kids, of course, are singing, "Bush, Bush, listen well, we said goodbye with a pair of shoes." End of quote.
And who are those? Who are
these
those
are the
kids?
Nieces and nephews of the Iraqi reporter who threw his shoes at George W. Bush back in December in the news conference. All the news you need to get started in the day.
All right, thanks so much, Femi. We may not be able to agree on whether Jay Leno will succeed in his new 10 p.m. five nights a week time slot on NBC, which starts tonight. But we can certainly agree that Jay Leno is a comic genius.
Fire destroys go-go bar. At least four men homeless.
What was the Gettysburg Address? Have you heard of it?
Yes, I've heard of it. I don't know the exact address.
Who lives in Vatican City?
The Vatican.
The Vatican. Starting tonight, Jay Leno's exploration of the depths of ignorance in American society will be showcased at 10 o'clock starting Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Here to talk about whether this is an entertainment story or a business story for General Electric and its subsidiary NBC is Mitch Semmel, longtime TV producer and network executive, now the president of Semmel Media. Good morning, Mitch.
Morning, John.
And Delana Dixon is owner of the TV pop culture blog DelanaDixon.com. She also joins us. Good morning, Delana.
Good morning.
So, you know, we can talk in a moment about the idea that there's nothing novel about comedy and variety shows being on in primetime. But I have a personal connection here, Delana, and let me just sort of explain it. I used to work for the show Dateline. You remember that show? It's still on the air, actually. There was a time back in the early part of this decade and even in the 90s that NBC considered, with the exception of Thursday night, when you wouldn't touch Thursday night because ER was such a success, you'd strip Datelines all across in prime time, maybe every night at 9 or every night at 8 o'clock. That didn't work for NBC back then. What makes NBC think they can succeed with Leno's comedy at 10 o'clock?
Well, you know, they're starting with a built-in audience. Jay Leno was getting 5 million viewers a night at 11:30 at night. And one of the things that he told me is that a lot of people would say they would watch his show if it was on a little earlier. So right now, NBC is in fourth place. Why not give it a shot? Give them the 10 p.m. slot. They really didn't want to lose Jay to another network, and this is an opportunity to keep him on the network and maybe discover some new viewers.
So it's a no-lose scenario for NBC already in fourth place. Mitch Semmel, does this break any entertainment ground, do you think?
I don't think it breaks entertainment ground, no. I think you're right in alluding earlier to the business ground that it may break.
And, you know, in terms of the actual programming, there are some lessons out there. I got two words for Jay Leno. Try Smothers Brothers.
For the start of his term, we are going to give our President Nixon our full support. That's right. And lay off the jokes entirely.
That's right.
He's going to be in office for at least 4 years, and I'm sure we'll be able to get around to him a little bit
later.
There's Tommy and Dickie Smothers on the famous Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which aired in the 60s and was so controversial it was taken off the air. Any likelihood we're going to see controversy on Jay Leno's show, Mitch?
I doubt it, and certainly not of that type. I think you're being generous to draw any comparisons to the Smothers Brothers in terms of smart political content. I think you'll see the same kind of comedy that you saw with Jay doing The Tonight Show.
And does that mean, Delana, that that if the ratings are great on Monday, what do they have to sustain, you know, say 2 months from now to be considered a success?
Well, the comedy sketches that he's going to do are going to have to be water cooler moments. People are going to have to feel, if they didn't watch last night and everybody's talking about it today, that they're going to have to watch that night so they can be in on the conversation. And it's going to be his celebrity guests. He's got Tom Cruise lined up. He's got Jerry Seinfeld. So hopefully these A-listers that he brings in on a daily basis doing things other than being on a couch where they'll actually be acting out in activities will bring people back day after day after day.
Yeah, well, Tom Cruise already jumped around on a couch for the Oprah show, and that was in the middle of the day. Well, if he's going to compete in sketch comedy, he's going to have to compete with the likes of Carol Burnett. Listen to this.
Ashley, my darling, I got something to tell you.
Well, I have
something. No. Let me tell you mine first, and then you can tell me yours. Mm. Oh, Brashley, I love you. 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 I really, really do love you. Now, what was it you wanted to tell me, darling?
I wish you'd have said that sooner. This isn't going to be easy.
Brashley, I love you. I love you.
Well,
I love you.
I married Melody this afternoon.
I hate you. I hate you. I hate you.
Carol Burnett sending up Gone with the Wind there with Harvey Korman. Can you do sketch comedy in this era five nights a week and compete with the likes of that weekly show?
It would be hard in any case, and let's be honest. Jay was never known for the great sketch comedy with The Tonight Show. So I wouldn't expect the writing quality to change at 10 o'clock.
But if, and Delana mentioned this in her conversation with Jay Leno, and I want to ask you about that, Delana, but let me just direct this at Mitch first. If it's all about people watching a little earlier, that sort of is like code for older viewers, which has got to be toxic for NBC.
It could be, but remember, it's also code in a way for people who don't yet have TiVos, for people who have long commutes, maybe going to sleep earlier.
I've got a long commute and I don't have a TiVo.
Delana, if Leno is successful with older viewers, is that a failure for NBC?
Well, you think about CBS. They have the older viewers, and they're the number one network out there. So if NBC can kind of steal a little bit of their fire and bring them to their networks, then they're actually, that could be considered success for NBC. And with Jay Leno doing his favorite segments, you know, the jaywalking and headlines at the end of the night, it's a great lead-in for older audience who want to watch the news, and that's the biggest audience at 11 o'clock. So it could be brilliant for NBC.
Let me give you one last sort of water cooler moment from the old days of primetime comedy. Listen to this, guys.
Hey, listen, Kathy, why don't we go up to my place tonight? You know, I'm a marvelous cook.
Really? What's your specialty?
Breakfast.
That's a bit from Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. That program was water cooler every time it was on during the week. I mean, that's a pretty high bar for Jay Leno. Mitch and then Delana.
Well, remember, also, Jay, in, I think, 17 years on The Tonight Show, was known for one water cooler moment that I can remember. Hugh Grant.
Ooh, yeah, right.
Right, but that's it. If I pressed you, John, could you name any others after that?
Delana, would you give Leno better marks than Mitch Semmel just gave him?
Oh, well, I think having Obama on was pretty exciting for him, and I know he wants to bring Oprah on. You know, you have to think about it. Jay is, he's already got an audience out there. He doesn't want to alienate his first audience, so he's going to do a lot of things that he did before, and hopefully all those people will come back to him, and he can bring in new people who didn't watch him at 11:30, and I think for him, that's what's considered success.
Comedy Central does comedy, if I'm not mistaken, 7 nights a week in primetime and everywhere else. You know, does that change the game for Jay Leno, Delana, and then Mitch?
Well, I think that there's just room for more. I mean, he's kind of using a little bit of the Jon Stewart concept of having sketch comedy on his show. So he's kind of taking that angle, and now it's going to be on broadcast television for people who don't really watch cable.
Delana Dixon, owner of the TV pop culture blog, DelanaDixon.com. Thanks so much. Final thought, Mitch. Can celebrities do it if the sketch comedy doesn't work?
They can do it. I mean, remember, NBC is going to try to define success differently in business terms, you know, by the money they save and the money they make, not in terms of the ratings they get.
ER is more expensive than Jay Leno, even at his salary. Mitch Semmel, longtime TV producer and network executive, now the president of Semmel Media. Tune in to Leno and let us know if you think it worked. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're also accepting your explainers on the incomprehensible healthcare debate. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.